Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Now, as you know, we are hurtling towards episode 200, and we have secured our special guest, so more clues to follow in relation to who that might be, but that will be a live event in front of an audience, so we'll share details too. Keep checking out the YouTube channel. There's about 170 videos on there now. We had about 400,000 views last month, so we're building momentum, but check it out, subscribe. We are building the community, and as we build the community, we build the opportunities and really the exciting guests that we can bring you. So with this, I always, as you hear me say, time and time again, need someone far wiser than myself. And in a world that is constantly changing and a world that is constantly noisy, many leaders have a conversation about how do you sense make? How do you, in some ways, translate that noise into some form of signal, into some form of vision, into some form of communication? So how do we tune in to a noisy world? So trust me, you don't want to miss this particular episode because I have the wonderful Nuala Walsh with me, who is, amongst many things, a behavioral scientist, a TEDx speaker, someone who has voted top 100 influential women in finance. There are so many other things, but she'll do a much better job than me of telling you all about it. Come back to me just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Nuala, welcome to The Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Thank you very much. Great to be here. I am doing very well.
So is this your first podcast in a studio, or have you done many of these?
No, I've done a few, but none as nice as this, Adam.
I always like to ask that question because James and Jesse are just the other side of the screen, and I know that they'll be smiling and delighted with it. Really appreciate you taking the time to come in, and there are literally so many things that I want to talk to you about. What I want everyone watching and listening to understand a little bit about your journey, and I shared just a few things in relation to the TEDx speech that you did, the behavioral scientist piece, the work in finance. How have you ended up here, Nuala?
That is a good question. It's a funny question in some respects, because you define yourself so much in terms of what you are, what your title is for years. And I guess I've had a pivot in the last 5 or 6 years. I'm a 30-year veteran of financial services. So for many years, that's sort of, you know, who you are and what you do and you are your title.
Yep.
But I guess 5 or 6 years ago, I changed track. I went back to school, which wasn't easy.
And I was going to say, how was that?
Yeah, I did a master's in behavioral science at the London School of Economics, because I was always interested in psychology. When I left college, I did forensic psychology.
Oh, wow.
And very interesting and very useful in the corporate world, believe it or not. So I did that, and what I wanted to do was apply the science of human behaviour to business. And in fairness, I really just wanted to understand how people thought. And it was a fantastic way to put a label on the different behaviours, the different mistakes that people make. So I left corporate life, set up my own business, Mind Equity Consulting, which is sort of a blend of, I was a CMO, so it was a blend of reputation management, behavioural change, but, you know, basically focusing on applying a behavioral diagnostic to business decisions, because at the end of the day, every business problem is a behavioral problem. But people don't see that. They see it as, you know, a culture problem, or, you know, a product problem, or a motivation problem. They don't typically bring it back to what is the underlying cause.
Exactly.
So today I do that. And I also sit on a number of boards across sports, the Innocence Project, which is about the wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
So really, I feel really strongly about that. I think that's a fantastic charity. I do a lot of work there. And then some business boards as well. So sport, business, and charity work.
It's a wonderful mix. And I have so many questions already just based on that outline. What do you think was the deciding factor for you to walk away from a 30-year, highly successful career within corporate life? What was the turning point for you where you thought, I'm going to do something different? And you went back to school, but what happened or why?
Yeah, well we had a merger. So mergers are never pretty.
Right.
But it was before the merger, I'd actually applied to the London School of Economics to do this master's. And, you know, you get to a point where you've been through several mergers, you do the same thing over and over again. And the reason that I started joining boards, my first board was UN Women, was because I suppose I just wanted to do something a little bit different.
Okay.
And that was my first springboard. And I guess one of the main takeaways that I have is that everything you do is a springboard to something else. I sponsored the Lions. I'm ending up on the British and Irish Lions board now. So everything does sort of come full circle. But for me, I really wanted to, I suppose I wanted to give it a go myself as well and just see what, you know, what would happen. A lot of companies focus on what's logical, not what's the psychological.
Right.
And again, that was. I mean, there was no guarantee it would work, obviously. It's always a risk. It's always a gamble taking that pivot.
Yeah.
But I'm actually delighted. I'm actually 5-6 years on. I'm delighted now. I'd never go back. And I think I'd never go back because I found something through my writing, through my teaching, about behaviour science, about human behaviour, something that I love doing. I said to my husband, I'll never be bored, you know, because you'll always, the field is so vast that there's always something to talk about. My hobby is actually explaining any of the things that you read about in the media, any of the scandals, any of the things that go wrong in terms of what are the behavioural drivers, what are the biases. So, I mean, a small example is the British Post Office.
Of course.
So, you know,
well, that's at the forefront of many people's minds, isn't it, right now?
Exactly. And you can attribute it to one or two things. But actually, if you dig deep into all of these different factors, it's a more nuanced and a more interesting analysis because people like to rush to judgment and explain behaviour in terms of simple terms. You know, oh, it's greed or, oh, it's
headline,
ego.
That's a headline, isn't it?
It's a headline. You're absolutely right. And it's way more complex than that. So for me, the interesting thing is looking at the configuration of biases that are at play and what are the force multipliers in that scenario or any scenario. But it's fascinating. And I think I argue really that it's a huge benefit for leaders. But we don't see it and we're too busy. We're all too busy rushing around and doing a million things to actually take the time to pause and think, what's actually happening? What are people really saying? And to, I guess, tune into these second level meanings and third level meanings of what people are saying or doing rather than just, you know, accepting what can be misinformation. It's a different form of misinformation if you just take what people say.
Again, so many questions for me. You obviously have a passion and a curiosity when you talk about the behavioural side of things and in some ways stripping down why people do what they do. Where's that coming from?
It's a great question. I don't know, really. I've had it since I was young. I've had it, you know, since I was in school. One of the earliest books that I read was about understanding human behavior. It wasn't called understanding human behavior. It was analyzing, I guess, situations in your home or stuff. So I wanted to understand a little bit more about, I can't remember the name of the first one. I'm okay, you're okay. Must have been something my mother had. One of those kind of self-help books. And then I started what happens is you see yourself in there and then you become more interested in why do you think X, why does something happen? So really, if you understand yourself, and I start with understanding myself, actually.
Yes.
Until you understand yourself, you can't understand other people. I don't think you can lead people as well as if you do. That is the root cause. You have to understand because then you can apply it and then you can be...
Lead self before leading others.
Exactly.
I agree
and
with
understand
you.
Self, I think.
Well. And and all of the warts and opportunities that come with that. Were your parents in this arena? Was that something behind again this focus or interest in understanding self or analysis?
No, not necessarily, not at all. Actually, so it was just just built up over time, and then I became curious about actually serial killers. Believe it or not,
right.
So this forensic, this interest in the criminals, and it's hugely popular. I mean, people, it's a massive industry, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So my interest, I think I was obsessed with the O.J. Simpson trial.
Quite, I remember it well.
Exactly, and I watched every. It must have been during the holidays. It must have been during some summer holidays. But I remember watching every single, you know, courtroom scene. And so yes, it was about the case, and it was a bit. This case was salacious and tragic and everything, but it was also about. Why did someone like that who loved his wife or his ex-wife do that? And that sort of was one of the early stories that really caught my interest. Why do people who care about other people, how do they end up you know, doing such things? And what is it? And what are the triggers? Now, you can't, I mean, I'm not a shrink, but I still wanted to
know.
We
can turn this into a therapy session.
But I still wanted to know and was curious about what it was. And then fast forward into business life or into general life, into relationships. And I think it becomes, it's a hugely valuable tool. I used to do it subconsciously. I used to just have general conversations with people and I might say something, they say, "My God, you've been analysing me." And I didn't realise it, but I probably was, without thinking about it. So I sort of developed this habit or hobby, I'm not sure which, in terms
of... maybe a little bit of both.
In terms of analysing people.
It's funny you mentioned the O.J. Simpson trial, because obviously we overlap slightly, because as I was training to be a barrister in life at the bar, excuse my voice, the O.J. Simpson trial was a big deal, wasn't
that's
it?
Right,
and remember that
right.
The famous line, I think, from Johnny Cochran was, "If the glove don't fit, acquit."
Yeah.
And that was a way we always, you know, we're trying to help lawyers understand the power almost of the headline or that memorable capture of what the case is all about. So I'm interested that you've now expanded and you're looking at sport. You talked about the British and Irish Lions. Mm. And I'm hoping that actually one of the players is going to come on previous from the British and Irish Lions. It was an episode that hasn't happened. We hope it will happen. But also the Innocence Project. So there's quite a mix there. Is that deliberate or has that just been a series of opportunity knocks?
It's a great question. No, it's a series of opportunities.
Right.
That's what I say. So my board positions now. So because I sponsored something once upon a time, I ended up... people associate you with whatever you do. I think I said my first board role was a charity role, was with UN Women. Now, this was 10, 15 years ago.
Okay.
But then people see you in that D&I space. And now, for example, I'm on the FA Inclusion Advisory Board. So suddenly everything starts to come into a pattern.
Yes.
So, no, it wasn't. But the Innocence Project came from the forensic psychology of years ago. So and now I teach it. I teach it at guest lecture, you know, at the University of Greenwich.
Okay.
And I've met some of the exonerees and they feature in some of my work and some of my writing. Because again, tremendous stories, not just about why the perpetrator does what they do, but how people who have everything against them battle through and survive. And the exoneree stories, they're horrendous stories, but the individuals who come through are so admirable, and they don't get the airplay and they don't get the recognition and they don't get the opportunities to reintegrate into society. They really are they're very sad cases, but when you listen to them, they just say they take one day at a time.
Yeah.
They're grateful for everything and they accept their lot and they try and fight They're fascinating stories. They really are. So in the Innocence Project, we try to raise awareness. The girl who leads it is... or founded it, you know, is really committed to criminal justice reform. Now, I'm not a lawyer, yeah, so you know that's not my bag. But what I have studied is how juries and jurors are not only biased, but really unaware of their bias. Mm. So I'll give you just a small example. Juries, you know, you could sit on a jury for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you would think that, well, you come in with the hypothesis and you look at the individual and you decide guilty or innocent. And we all do that. We have first impressions and we rush to judgment. So you would imagine, but know after weeks and weeks and weeks of evidence, that they would change their mind. Only a third of jurors change their mind, according to some of these studies, which is actually dreadful, because it's pure confirmation bias. It means that you and we do it in business. You decide...
Well, we're human, so
exactly.
That's what we're talking about, really.
So you decide someone is talented, you decide someone isn't talented,
yep.
Someone's right for the job, whatever, and you reinforce those views with confirmation bias all the time. But even learning that,
yes.
I think, is hugely, hugely valuable.
So no wonder you were interested in what is going on with the post office as well. Did you see the recent series on TV, going behind the jury? And the double jury, and make of that what you will, but it's interesting. We're going to have Nazir Afzal back on the show as well, who was part and parcel of that in his role as former chief crown prosecutor. And he's done a lot of work in relation to some of the injustices that are going on, especially from a diversity perspective. So that will be an interesting conversation too. I'm asking you these questions because I'm trying to understand, this is where my passion comes in. I can rattle off all of the things that you've achieved, which are... many things that people will look at and think, oh, I wonder if I could ever achieve that, or what a great role model for either for business or a female, all of these things. Here's the question, though. especially at the moment, why do you do what you do?
Well, I guess I'd have to say which bit you're referring to. If it's,
I think now the passion that you're showing for the last 5 years of the work of the boards, of the learning, of the writing, what's why?
Because I think, as I said, when you understand, if I knew the stuff that I knew now, would I make the same mistakes? Well, I like to think I wouldn't, but I might. I probably would because we're all predictable. But at least I want to teach people. I've nieces and nephews, and they're all climbing the ladder, and they're trying to do this, that, and the other. And I think if you actually listened or tried to take on board some of these insights, you would go further, faster. You'd avoid some errors. It would be more pain-free. I don't guarantee painless, but I do guarantee a bit less pain and a bit and fewer regrets. Because if you choose to tone down, slow down, and I say that when I, speak and live at 100 miles an hour, but I still know I need to do it.
Yep.
But I do reinterpret what people say, and I do reflect on what people say, because I do think that that's the mistake that we make. We rush to misjudgment, not judgment, and we tone out and tune out the voices that really matter. We rely on familiar voices, similar voices. Even when people give you warnings in business, do you really listen? If your partner says it's not working out, do you actually listen, pay attention to that? Whether you're a therapist, whether you're a parent listening to a child with issues, teenagers with issues.
Yes.
These are sensitive conversations. And in a noisy world, when we are too busy, we're too frantic, we're rewarded by speed, by quick decisions, being a quick decision maker.
Everything's now, isn't it?
Everything is now, and everything's even yesterday. The crisis is growing, and all you need to do is look at the facts. I mean, you look at all of the scandals, the scams. How many people are caught with scams because they just dived in and didn't think twice?
Well, that's the big pace, thing right now, isn't it?
Exactly. The pace of misinformation, disinformation,
fake news.
There are so many examples, but even really accomplished CEOs, who lead huge banks and huge companies, they just, they're so much on the single track, and they're so busy and so intent on a narrow view and a narrow perspective, they can get it as wrong as they get it right.
Yes.
And we've seen some casualties, quite a few. I mean, look at Liz Truss is one example that springs to mind. Didn't listen, focused completely on tunnel vision, her view. She believed it was right. But even when the IMF came in, still wouldn't listen to an independent view and went down that track and lasted whatever it was, 44 days in office. So someone who's got a huge opportunity, had the ear of the nation, just so single-minded, wouldn't listen to other people. And even if listened, justified their own beliefs. And I think that's what we do.
And that all got played out in public.
It's a source of error, but it's a source of predictable error.
So let me tell you some of the current thinking from us, from the podcast as well. I got asked a question only a couple of weeks ago when someone said, well, why do you uniquely exist as a podcast? Which I think is a great question. Mm-hmm. We're a leadership podcast, but if I go slightly further down, a passion of mine has always been human-centered leadership. That's the work that I've done, the book, the research, the articles. If I go a little bit lower, excuse my voice, if I go a little bit lower, then I'm very keen to understand the human being over the human doing, which is why I was asking you about why do you do what you do as opposed to what you've achieved, because that's interesting, but I'm ring-fencing it slightly to understand what's underlying, which is getting to your passion of human behavior. Mm. And then I think really almost the foundation for this is in a world that's gone bonkers and won't stay still and is full of noise, how do people just thrive and cope within that, almost from a self-preservation perspective, regardless of whether they're the newest intern or they're the CEO of a big global multinational? And that's why I really want to start to zone in on some of the work that you've done, both the TEDx talk and also the new book that we'll speak about as well. Now, you did the TEDx talk in relation to decision making, or maybe even lack of.
Correct.
And so tell us how that came about first.
Well, I did it on indecision. I did it at the University of Salford.
Yep.
And it was a great opportunity because it's quite hard to, people say, I'll do a TEDx talk. And I will say they're incredibly hard. They really are. You're 18 minutes max. You don't have any notes. You have to memorize it. And when you look at someone doing it, you think it looks really easy. And people forget that actually, no, you've had to memorize it. You've had to learn it. Never mind the content. So the content is one thing, which I think is quite hard
Yes.
to deliver your content in 18 minutes. Anyway.
So timing's important as well. Let's just everyone understand.
Absolutely. And then the actual delivery of it as well. I think is really key. But
did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy it as a challenge?
Oh, what a question! I don't know about that. Would I do it again? It's probably the acid test. I think it's hard. I think it's hard to do it. I enjoyed when it was done. Enjoyed it being done. Enjoyed the fact that I did it. Did I enjoy it on the moment? No, I stood there before I got on. No, I would have rather do anything but get on there. And it's not that I was afraid of the audience. I wasn't.
No.
So I don't mind public speaking. I didn't mind that. I didn't mind the people in the room. I minded the worry that I was going to, because I liked my topic. I liked my message. I was worried because it was going to be captured forever that I stuttered, you know, or stumbled or forgot where I was going, even though I knew I could counteract it and I would keep going. I suppose that was it. So this whole thing about public speaking for people, I think it looks way, and podcast hosting, it always looks easy to do these things, but it isn't. I think it's a real skill. And unless you've done it, it's very easy to criticise people, a podcaster or someone who does a TEDx talk, unless you've done it yourself. I think it's a hard thing to do. But I am glad I've done it. And I'll tell you why I'm glad. Interestingly, in the audience, I'm glad because it's helped people, which sounds, you know, a bit naff maybe. I've had people come back to me and actually say to me, there was a woman in the audience who wrote to me, a Muslim lady, and she said her child was in the audience at the time and said, you know, she listened to your talk and she was really struggling with something and it really helped her. So because she was indecisive about something. And for me, that actually was useful. And then I sat on an advisory board with a company.
Yep.
And the head of that company listened to it and said, oh, well, I was going to set up a new board practice and now I'm not. So actually, people make practical changes on the back.
Real impact.
So that I find that actually quite rewarding.
So people can go and watch that TEDx talk, and I know it's been viewed many hundreds of thousands of times, which is, some, when you think about that, that's quite frightening in itself, but also what a privilege for that to get out to so many people and having a real impact on people. Just help people understand, what were some of the key messages from you about trying to move away from indecision, especially in a world where it's incredibly noisy and there's information coming at us from northeast, southwest, much of which is false, or as you say, is playing to biases. What were some of the key messages that you wanted to land that you can share today?
Well, for indecision, it's temporary.
Yep.
It is a state of mind. It's hidden. In business, it's hidden. No one admits that they're indecisive because you can't, because you're paid and your clients pay you to make a decision. So that was one of the points. But the takeout was that you can control it more easily than you think. Because in actual fact, the reason you're indecisive is I think you boil it down to one of three things.
Okay.
You either think the decision's too hard. You know, you've got this proportional lens. It's too hard.
Yep.
I can't make the decision now. Or you think it's too far in the future. I don't have to make it. You know, it's over there. I'm not going to
manana,
do it.
Manana.
Yeah. Or it's too difficult. So you've got an emotional lens. So you've got this easy, hard kind of spectrum. So so you've got these three spectrums of how you consider the decision. And if you break down each one, so even the one about, you know, it's too big. It's too big a problem.
Yep.
Climate change or world peace, or will I speak up? So will I speak up is quite a big decision. You break it down into smaller tasks, or like any project would. So I gave the example of how the moon landing, for example, you know, is a massive thing. And people might look at that and go, will we land on the moon or won't we? And this is in 1969, that example.
Or did we land on the moon?
Well, indeed.
That's another podcast.
That is. But that's actually, I mean, if you read Michael Collins' book, that's actually thousands. And for 3 years, they compiled questions. So that wasn't, will we do it or won't we? The go, no-go decision. That was the series of answering thousands of questions.
So it was iterative, the process.
Correct. But they broke it down. My point was they broke it down. They shrunk the problem. So you shrink the problem, you make it smaller. You visualize the problem in the future and you bring the future forward. So like retirement, well, you know, if you don't save for retirement, to pick an obvious one because people don't.
Yes.
Well, break it down into real terms. I won't be able to go on my holiday. Instead of going on a holiday every year, I'll only be able to afford to go every 3 years. Well, that's pretty real. I can relate to that right now. I can't go on my holidays. Or, you know, I buy two bottles of wine, I'll say a week. You know, I can only buy them two bottles of...
You're amongst friends here, it's fine.
I was going to say a day, but, you know. But the point is you visualise it and you bring it back to the... And then for reframing it, you reframe the problem into something easier as well.
Okay. Now, that resonates because I've heard maybe some people talk about procrastination or people making big decisions or big projects, and they talk about chunking it. Just chunk it into small bits.
That's
and
right.
just start to move forward bit by bit by bit, so it doesn't feel overwhelming. So there's an element of overlap
right.
there, isn't there, with it? Let me come on to really your new book. Let's hold this up so that the cameras can see that. Now, this is out when?
26th of March.
Okay, and it's how to make smarter decisions in a noisy world. So really, that's what I want to zone in on. What do you mean by a noisy world, firstly, Nuala?
Very good question. Noisy is actually the actual noise, but it's also the fact that it's fast-paced, which is one problem. So you get the attention problem.
Yep.
It's fast-paced, it's high-speed, it's visual. So the other problem is that it's a visual world, and it's just coming at us so quickly. So it's as you'd expect. It's noisy, full of noise, too much data, too much information, no headspace, no time to think. You know, we're time starved, attention deprived.
Everything's now, now, now.
But what I'm doing is that's the external world. What I argue is that it's the same inside your head.
Right.
So the external world is, you know, pressure, pressure, deliver, deliver. But inside your head, it's as noisy. It's the stories you tell yourself or don't. It's, you know, the risks you take or don't. And what I've done is I've identified 10 misjudgment traps, so that in certain scenarios you are more prone to tuning out the voices that matter and making good decisions than you are at any other point. And so, for example, I'll give one chapter on power. So
power.
Power.
Oh,
yeah.
Talk to you about
the power.
The
power-related derailers.
Yep.
Okay. So if you want power, so you're a power seeker. So they're very different. There are three different categories. You're either a power seeker,
you're
desperate for power. Power and recognition, call it power recognition. Or you have the power. Now you're a power holder. You hold that power and you are Mr. Big Dog or Mrs. Big Dog and you've got the power. You're desperate to hold on to it.
Right.
Now, or you're a third category, which is you've lost power or you're afraid of losing power. You're in that space where I used to be, you know, the CEO. I used to be the head of X. I used to be in the media all the time and now I'm no longer. So you've lost power. What are the biases that come into play in those situations that make you go off track and make the wrong decision? Donald Trump is a really obvious example.
Okay.
He was losing power. Then you had the Capitol riots. So that's an example of someone who was afraid of losing power. And even though he held power, he wanted to maintain power, etc. So there are lots of different examples of how people who have power lose power and what comes into play. And then you've ego biases. And there's some fantastic examples there. I picked one just to give you a flavour. Jack Ma from Alibaba held massive power as the Chinese billionaire. He didn't listen to his inner voice. He went in 2020 or 2022. He made a speech at the Bundesbank where he basically criticised the Chinese government. But before he started his speech, he said something really interesting. He said, "I didn't know whether to come here today and make this speech." And what that said to me was, and it was just in the notes, it was just in the transcript that I noticed, and that said to me, so you knew what you were going to say was wrong, but you said it anyway. And you went ahead and did it anyway. And you criticised the Chinese government. And 2 weeks later, you know, the biggest IPO in history was pulled and he disappeared from public view for 2 full years. So my point is, even when you hold power, boundary, your mindset, your perimeters can be so narrow, or you're so overconfident that you just don't see the writing on the wall, or you don't hear that voice that says, "No, don't say that. That's the wrong thing to say." So even though you know it, I think it's one example. There are many examples.
I think there's a whole conversation to be had around power, because it's a word that sometimes I think can be weaponized. Mm. But it's a word that also needs definition or context.
That's right.
Why are so many of us defined by our role? Because I remember talking to one CEO who was the CEO of a highly recognized organization. I knew him socially, and I remember one of his biggest fears was he just wouldn't be that person. Mm. And I thought to myself, well, you're the same person, and I know you in a social context, and you are this person. But what is that definition? When you say to someone, you know, kind of, who are you? And the first thing they might lead with is, "Hi, I'm the CEO of so-and-so." I said, "Well, thank you for telling me know what you do, but that's that's not who you are."
Yeah.
What's going on there?
I think it's this obsession, and it's worse now, way worse now. It's this obsession with identity, and we all have it. But again, and I do have a chapter on identity, as it happens, how this labelling, the obsession with labelling and impression management and curation of who you are and what you want to be seen as, can make you make the wrong decisions. I mean, and we saw, didn't we see the Anna Sorokin case in New York, where she pretended to be Anna Delvey, desperate to be the German heiress, and she defrauded all of you know, New York society. But it's everyone. We all have it. So I think there's a healthy proportion of that. You do need to have an identity. You do need to be somebody. But when you become obsessed with that title, and that goes back to my earlier point of you have to have the title. You have to be the best. You have to be the number one, the fastest selling, you know, the fastest runner even in whatever your domain is. That's when it becomes a problem, because you don't see the wood for the trees. You make the decision based on how will it impress other people rather than do I actually want to do this job? And I'll give you my own example.
Yep.
When I did leave corporate life, I was called for big jobs, and there was one job, and I went the whole way down the track, and I thought, you know, I don't really want this job. I want to say I have this job, but I don't actually really want this job, because it was a nice big title and it was a nice big company. I thought, yeah, well, wouldn't that be good? But actually, when I stood outside the building, I thought, I don't really want, I've done it. I don't really, and it was such a revelation to me.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, and I chased my titles for a very long time. And I thought all I wanted to be was X or Y or Z. So I think it's really understandable, but it is a control. It controls you, and you give away your own personal power when you're chasing those titles. And you do impact your own well-being, your own happiness, and your own pursuit of whatever it is that you have, that you like to do.
So this almost reminds me of last week's episode with Gary Krotauser, as regards an unlocked moment where you perhaps had an unlocked moment where you knew where you were and who you were with, and you realised something that maybe you hadn't thought about before was, that is not what I want. That is not the direction of travel. Sorry, you have to excuse my voice. So I'm interested in, so who is Nuala? Who are you now then? So in relation to all of the things you've achieved and all of the roles that you've had and all the roles that you hold and the passion you have at the moment, who are you?
Well, good question. Who is anybody? But I would say probably I am that behavioural scientist now who applies it to business and my life and my family and everybody else. So I think that's probably first. And I teach. I do an awful lot of work with a lot of universities. And I write regularly. And I guess if I didn't like it, I wouldn't do it. So I enjoy my client work. They love this whole field because people love to know about themselves. People love to know, what am I doing wrong? I give a lot of talks about the unconscious mistakes that leaders make, because it helps people stop.
Yeah.
And when people understand themselves, they can do better in the role. So I think I'm a much calmer person than I used to be. My husband would probably laugh, but, you know, I think I probably am.
We'll ask him for feedback on this episode.
But I do things now that I've never done. I enjoy doing things. You know, I look after my mother. I've become part of it. I'm a carer. My mother's 85. And I now play a much stronger role in her life than I ever did when I was working.
Okay.
So, you know, that would have to be a factor. And I think everyone's a jigsaw. So I don't think there is a simple answer to anyone. Who is anybody? You know, we are all a composite of different selves. But that is one side that maybe has come out in the last while.
So I'm hearing
probably didn't before.
Yeah, and listen, thank you for answering that question, because I'm hearing a lot of care come out with that, actually. Care for others and maybe giving back. Mm. So this is all about impact. And listen, you're still going, but I'm always interested in almost what the legacy will be. What is it you are setting up, or you're hoping will be said about you when you're not in the room? And I think that's important for any leader in relation to the impact that he or she has. Let me come back, because we digress slightly from the book. For anyone watching or listening to this now, what would be maybe the two or three of the key insights that you would like to offer people who have got to make decisions on a day-to-day basis in a world that has gone quite mad and is incredibly noisy, as you've described? What do you think are the top two or three things that leaders should have on their mind in order to try and get this right?
I think, because it's a visual world, I'm trying to focus on not blind spots, but deaf spots. And I think we've unheard voices, we've polarization, we've people entrenched in their views, because it's a visual world and people aren't pausing. So the overall message is really to try and get people to pause. Now, and that's easier said than done, but to actually think, even if you just simply say, am I a tuned out leader or a tuned in leader? If you're tuned out, there is trouble. There is trouble ahead.
I think you talked about tone deaf leadership somewhere.
Right. And I do think there's a crisis of tone deaf leadership now. People aren't listening.
Right.
A, they can't, and B, they don't want to in many cases. So, and And all you need to do is look at M&A failure. You can look at, you know, school shootings, all of the terrorism attacks, missed signals. The problem is, if you're not tuned in, you're missing signals. That's it, in a nutshell. And what you don't want to miss the signals that matter. Not every signal, because, you know, but the signals that matter when they matter. And I think that's the most important thing. And yes, I have a framework in the book. Yes, I've got like 18 strategies and I've got all the tips and all the tools for people to do it. But if in the beginning you don't even see yourself, if you arrogantly and naively maybe see yourself as someone who is, oh, I'm very tuned in. We all think we're great listeners. We all think we're great decision makers. But if you don't even get to that point where you think, you know, I have got it wrong. I don't want to get it wrong. I want to understand why I've got things wrong in the past. I certainly do guarantee that, you know, with the book, that you will be able to explain why you've got things wrong in the past. And by definition, that should help you avoid it in the future. So it is paying much more attention to, are you really as tuned in as you should be and could be? And what signals are you missing?
So am I right in thinking that one of the biggest challenges leaders will have is actually just to stop and pause and take in maybe what's around them? Because sometimes I also hear about the difficulty of picking up on weak signals. There are weak signals all over the place. And sometimes it is difficult to take those and put them together and two equals five. Mm. So is this about stopping and pausing? And sometimes we hear the term strategically think. And let's be honest, that really means just, for God's sake, just stop what you're doing and take some time out.
It's, do you know, again, that's a simple way of saying that. I would say it's that combined. It's not that on its own, but you have to do a bit of that. That's a starting point. It's do it to understand and reinterpret what people are saying. It's not listen. It's reinterpret what people are saying when it matters, the important things.
Yes.
So when people present, give you presentations, always ask, what's their agenda? You know, rather, don't take things at face value. Don't rush to judgment. Don't jump to conclusions. On important matters, you think you don't, but you are. Human nature says you are, and you're doing it anyway. The smart people don't. The smart people at least try and stop. And I give a lot of examples of people who have done it well, but more people haven't.
Okay.
So there are more examples of people who haven't done it well than those who have. But on balance, you don't want regret. You don't want to make these mistakes in life.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? I was going to ask you a question which has now completely escaped my mind because it was actually on that. What was the question I was about to ask? God, that was right at the tip of my tongue and it's gone. Okay, I'll come back to it. It's absolutely fine. It will just shoot into my head at some point. I know that you have also spoken to multiple people, whether they are presidents, dare I say, sports personalities, executives. So you've spoken to quite an eclectic mix of people. What are some of the interesting insights that you have picked up on from those who have successfully led in very diverse ways? In fact, as I've said that, I've just remembered the question, and I'll come back to it. But what have you picked up and thought, this is interesting from how you lead well, or how you galvanize people, or how you do exactly what you're describing in the book? Tell me a little about that.
Well, it's funny you say that. I did pick up things about their leadership style, but I was always more interested in them as a person, whoever they were.
The human being.
The human being.
Okay.
Yeah, the human being. I always wanted to get behind the person. So I did interview presidents. I did interview the first man on the moon. And I was more interested in understanding the individual.
Right.
So I understand that people would want to ask him about, you know, the state of the economy or about, you know, the turbocharged engine. How did you actually land on the moon? I understand all of that.
Yep.
My interest was in the person because I knew as much as anyone would know.
You just defined the podcast, basically, which is exactly that.
Exactly. So I did want to get behind the person. And what I learned was, I guess there are frailties. And that's what I wanted to see. I just wanted to think, oh, you're like the rest of us.
Human.
Then. You're like the rest of us. I mean, I'll give you one example. I asked Jose Maria Olazabal once upon a time, and maybe it's about leadership, public speaking we talked about earlier, about nerves.
Yes.
So I said, so how do you deal with pressure when you're about to take that shot and it's, you know, win or lose? And, you know, high pressure stakes, a lot of money on the table, etc. Now, I was, really my question was, how did he deal with pressure? I was asking the question because I must have had a big presentation or something, or something coming up. So my question was around dealing with pressure. But his answer actually fitted it very well. He said that your body gets used to the nerves with the shot. The first time it's horrendous. And it's like going on stage, it is horrendous.
Yeah.
But your body gets used to this terrible feeling of anxiety and whatever. And then when it comes to the second, third, fourth, fifth time, you realize, yes, here's that thing again.
You acclimatize.
You acclimatize. Here it is again. And it's no longer, you don't get as bad a stage fright as you do in the beginning.
Yeah.
And that was interesting because when I worked with a lot of the CEOs and, you know, big leaders, and we deliberately chose big names and high profile individuals as guest speakers, I saw how nervous they were. I was shocked at how nervous they were because I'm thinking, you've got, how could you be nervous? And it was encouraging, and I guess it showed some of the frailties that people had. Then, okay, you can see how people make mistakes. Yeah, and what I also learned is that each of those leaders, any of the people that you have here, has got something wrong somewhere. And have they learned? Sometimes they survive, sometimes they don't. But what I found and what I wrote about in the book was those who did get it wrong, how they picked themselves up. I gave the example of John McEnroe. And
right.
We used to work with John on the seniors tour. And
I say that's probably one of the things on my bucket list of life is to play tennis with John because I'm a big tennis fan.
Oh, fantastic.
So, yes.
But I used him, and I deliberately tried to put stories in the book where I had some connection.
Yes.
So some of the people I didn't know at all, but anywhere where I knew somebody, I just wanted to at least bring in the story. Now, I don't think, in the book I didn't say I knew him, but I just put him in because I did.
Yes.
But I was interested again in the character and the personality.
Right.
And but he had trouble in the 80s. You know, he lost his marriage, broke up. I would say he lost his career, but he came off the tennis pinnacle. But he reinvented himself. So for me, the lesson is, look at this person who's reinvented himself. And now he is the most sought after commentator in the US. He is probably one of the biggest names in tennis, certainly of that era.
Still,
I think he's huge.
Yeah. I'm a big tennis fan, and he's one of the greatest for a whole host of reasons.
Exactly. So, but he has he's got a fantastic team around him as well. So yes, he's the face of it all, but he has a great team around him as well. And I think, and I learned that from even watching all of the big players. You know, even when Bill Clinton was there, spoke at one of our events. I saw the team.
I was going to ask about your takeaway from interviewing Bill Clinton.
Yes,
because
I think there were three people in our marriage for a very long time, 6 months, because of all the research you had to do. What I learned was I had been warned that when you ask him a question, he doesn't always answer the question you ask, which is probably the politician's skill.
I was going to say, yeah.
Or worse. And I'm there, and it was my first time doing it, obviously. So I was there with all my questions. I had to read for literally 6 months in advance. So I think I knew everything about him at the time. I could have gone on Mastermind.
Right.
Because no matter what, because I knew he wasn't going to answer whatever I asked, even though I had all these questions. I had to be able to bounce into whatever he said. Oh, do you remember that? Or, oh, when you met Arafat, if that's what he came up with. So I had to really do my research. And that was quite difficult. I don't know what my takeaway was, really. My takeaway was he probably was, I think... people forgave him for his wrongdoing, if you like, because not just because he was charismatic. I mean, I think that's one thing.
People talk about a certain presence. He has a certain presence.
He does have it. But lots of other people have it too. He does have it. But I think it's the difference that he made. If you actually zone into what he did, you know, he did achieve, you know, the economic standard of excellence, and he did do all of these, introduced fantastic programs. He was such a great peace broker, you know, for Middle East at the time, Northern Ireland. He did all, and his interest in Northern Ireland because his mother had roots in Northern Ireland.
Right.
So again, I just saw that I felt sorry for him, believe it or not. And the question that moved him, I hadn't even got it on my piece, was, why does he just keep going and going? And you could see him visibly move in the chair. Like, he'd all his pit-pat answers for the political questions. But then when I said, what is it? What makes you keep going? Like, you've achieved all of this.
Mm-hmm.
You've written the books. You're now supposedly in retirement. Why? You could play golf, do all the things that he loves doing. What is it that makes him keep going and going and going? And I don't think he had an answer. He kind of just shifted around and looked uncomfortable. And now he came up with some answer. But it was one that definitely moved him out of the zone of, I'm giving the PC answers to these questions. And it was probably the one that I did want to know. And some people told me who watched the interview said that it was from that moment on that he started, you know, being much looser and much more himself. And that, for me, was the point when it went from interviewing the president to interviewing the person.
Yeah, I went from the human being to the human doing to the human being.
I was really pleased with that. And it was a difficult situation because in an investment with an investment audience, you think, do they want to hear about the greenback or do they want to hear about the individual?
Yeah.
So I think people wanted to hear the other side. So I was pleased with how it went.
How can people get hold of Tune In, the book that is soon to be available?
Well, they can either go on my website,
yep,
NulaGWalsh.com, or they can go to any Amazon store, Waterstones. It's actually available in all of the main places, but Amazon is probably the easiest for most people.
Understood. And we'll put those in the show notes as well. Now, there was a question that I had that disappeared and it's back. And it was this. A lot of leaders, and there's a lot of conversation now around how you as a leader need to proactively embrace diversity of thought. What are your thoughts in relation to doing that? So you're going to seek out the naysayers deliberately, not just creating the echo chamber, to be able to tune in to people with a very, very diverse view to yours. What are some of your thoughts or some of the work that you've done around that importance?
It's critical. I sit on a couple of boards,
yep,
and I remember joining one and they said, I remember before I joined, they said, well, we're a very collegiate board, Nula. I said, well, you know, wait till the rest of us come along. That'll probably put a stop to that. But what I've learned since on that board,
right,
is that when you have the diversity of thought, it's everything. The things aren't going to go according to plan. People don't always like that. But the problem is, you know, is that people like to be told, people only like to get opinions from people who agree with them, or who like them, or who look like them. So if you even think about who do you get your advice from, they're normally people who are like you, as you say. But I don't know, I've always wanted to hear the external view. It doesn't mean I'll take it, but how could you not?
But understand it first.
Understand it first. And in fairness, I sit on a group at the FA, actually, and it's a group of six people, and we work with the chair on a culture change. And I've got to say, the six people are radically different, radically different. Some are, you know, football experts and they live the game. Other people, you know, don't even play football and probably some mightn't even watch it. But it's a fantastic group. And we've been able to put together 88 different reforms that went and passed through council.
Right.
Because we really worked hard on presenting it, thinking it through. Now, obviously, the council decided they were appropriate and whatever. But we worked together to build the reforms, present the reforms, make the case for. Because, and I think part of that was because the chair, Debbie Hewitt, incredibly smart woman, put together a group that was incredibly diverse. And that group worked with the executive and with a number of other people, and we were able to effect change. And I think we wouldn't have got there if we weren't able to say, oh, how about that? And there was a lot of, you know, dissent, yep, with things. But it was done.
And the benefits were clear.
And, you know, I think it's, you do it within psychological safety. If you feel comfortable in that group, in any group,
yes,
and if you feel you're able to speak up in a comfortable group, I think that makes all the difference. And my own research is on whistleblowing, believe it or not. And I always encourage even clients, don't speak up unless you are, and I mean actually speak up rather than speak up in a meeting, unless the environment is safe to do so. And I think that's incredibly important. And the safer an individual feels, the more likely they are to just speak their mind. And, you know, that's why you have independent non-execs on boards, because they don't have a vested interest. They have nothing to lose. They're not looking for a job.
They can play devil's advocate.
They absolutely can.
Okay.
Absolutely can.
So here's my final question. With everything that you've experienced and all of this wisdom, what would be the best piece of leadership advice you'd want to share that you've ever given or received? Or certainly what floats to the surface?
Probably two things,
okay,
that I think have stood me good. And maybe the first one is, probably goes back to my grandmother of all people, God rest her.
Right.
Which is the do unto others as you'd wish them to do unto you. If you treat people the way you would like to be treated as a leader or as anything else, I think it takes you very far down the line. If you make a mistake with somebody, with a team member, you're a bit snappy or whatever, be sorry, say you're sorry and move on. So the first thing is actually just to try and be decent as much as you can, and not to you know, walk on people as you're climbing the ladder, because, you know, your day will come.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, your day.
There'll
only
be
one
a hefty
route.
Fall at some point.
You are coming down no matter where you are. That is a fact. So that one we all know. And I guess the second one is that has helped me move And I've done this since I was a teenager, which is I take every opportunity at them. I never said no to an opportunity that came along. I did once, and I didn't take a job when I wasn't happy with the company. I didn't move. I stayed in the under this delusion that things would work out and the status quo bias. I just, you know, it was easier to stay even though I wasn't happy. I didn't take that opportunity, and it's the one career regret that I have. So I go back to my original point, always take the opportunities. I got on boards, I met people, I try and put myself out there, even with the book. You know, I'm going to send the book to everyone who's in the book. I'm going to send it to lots of people in the hope that, you know, it reaches people and that the word gets out. Not because, not for any reason, you know, glory. I actually think it really is going to help people. And it, as I said, it'll help them avoid some clangers. I hope my family read it. I hope those nieces and nephews of mine, you know, that to me is a legacy, to give them something that they can actually find useful and apply in their life. And you know, it's got 55, 56 years worth of insight in there. And never mind everyone else's. It's got thousands of years from everyone else. And it brings together a compendium of the best insights from an awful lot of people. And that's, I suppose, what I'd like to leave.
And was that the driving force for writing it? Because I've written a book myself, and I know that it's not quite as simple as it may seem, if it does at all. What was the driving force for suddenly putting it all together?
I learnt, it was that thing about the labels, that we can now analyse behaviour in terms of, there are 200 biases.
Right.
I put 75 in the book and 10 traps. If you're able to point out it's the, you know, peak end rule or the illusion of invulnerability or the illusion of control or effective forecasting error, what a power that is. What an insight that is. So I thought it was a fantastic way to apply it, to get, tell some stories, a lot of really interesting stories, and it's a, it teaches people at the same time. And now that I'm able to analyse behaviour with those words, which I didn't have before, I certainly didn't have them before, I think it's a power, and I think it gives you a huge edge as a leader to be able to do that. And it helps not just you, but you. It's a call for responsibility. When you're in a position of power, that power holder, I think you have an obligation to do the right thing, to make the right decisions, and not to cause carnage and all of these predictable human errors that many leaders in power are now making when they shouldn't be. So,
well, it's a huge congratulations to getting the book out. As I say, it's no mean feat. And it's a massive thank you for making the time and the effort of coming into the Leadership Enigma. Couldn't even say it then, but there we go. Thanks very much.
Excellent, Adam. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.